Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
It is Rock and Roll Friday on the Savage Nation, and we're playing this song in honor of Helen Thomas, because I expect her to appear in short shorts any day after what she just done. Now, let's start at the top. Remember Helen Thomas, that old wackadoo? Remember the old wackadoo would always make cute anti-American, anti-Jewish statements, and the wonderful geniuses in the press corps would titter with delight because she was so, well, she was outspoken. And she was charming. Well, she was fired, as you know, thrown out of her job with the Hearst Corporation because she went crazy. I don't know what she said. I have it actually here. And she gives a speech yesterday in Michigan, and she says, Zionists control U.S. foreign policy and other American institutions, and goes on. And she starts to attack. Now, Helen Thomas, as you know, was the darling of the press corps. There's nothing she could say that wasn't tittered about. Long before there was Twitter, there was titter. And all those in the newsroom would titter at her because she was just so charming. And given that she hated America and hated Jews, it made her even more charming to the left-wing vermin in the media. And so she went on in this speech, and she says that the government is owned we're owned by propagandists against the Arabs. There's no question about that. She said Congress, the White House, and Hollywood, Wall Street are owned by the Zionists. No question, in my opinion, said Helen. They put their money where their mouth is. We're being pushed into a wrong direction in every way. Congress, the White House, Hollywood, and Wall Street. So now she's using the blood libel that Hitler used, only in a new way. And it's been used for over a century to incite hatred of the Jews. And I read you the other day that leads to death camps. Whether it's against the Jews or blacks or Hispanics or Asians or Arabs, it doesn't matter. She is a racist by all definition. So when she was asked by the Detroit Free Press how she would respond to those who say she's anti-Semitic, Thomas said, I'd say I'm a Semite. What are you talking about? Who are you? Who are you, she said. Are you a Semite? And she said, we all know that the Arabs are much maligned. They're automatically terrorists. And as she said, everything that we do basically is because of the Zionists. Now, if you remember, Thomas resigned from Hearst newspapers in June after telling a rabbi on camera that Israel should get the hell out of Palestine and go home to Poland, Germany, and America, and everywhere else. During her interview and speech, she went on about Zionists this, Zionists that, and I'll stop right here because I think you get the flavor of Helen Thomas and why she was fired by Hearst and where we are at today. Now, the reason I mention this is because I haven't seen the story anywhere, linked anywhere except on michaelsavage.com. And for the Semites amongst you or the Semitophiles amongst you, you can find the story on michaelsavage.com. Even for the Semitophobes, you can check it out. The Semitophobes can even check it out. Now, that leads me to this, because she said to one of the reporters when asked how she responded to those who say she's anti-Semitic, Thomas said, I'd say I'm a Semite. What are you talking about? Who are you? It's a good question. And I've asked myself, who am I? So I have a treat for you today. I sent my $99 into a genetics company, and I haven't had it done yet because I was intrigued by it. It says, learn from your DNA. With a simple saliva sample, will help you gain insight into your traits, from baldness to muscle performance. Discover risk factors for 91 diseases. Know your predicted response to drugs, from blood thinners to coffee, and uncover your ancestral origins. And there was a holiday sale where I get to spit into a test tube, and then I send it to them, and I get, I don't know, my health, my ancestry. I find out whether I'm liable to get type 2 diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, breast cancer, colorectal cancer, prostate cancer, celiac disease, Crohn's disease, restless leg syndrome. No, I'm not on MSNBC. Age-related macular degeneration, Parkinson's disease, Coumadin warfarin sensitivity. No, I'm not a rat. And a Plavix efficacy, something or other. So I can't wait to get this back, all from a little spit in a jar. I've been waiting for this virtually my entire life. And here, I got the kit now. I should do it on the air, but okay, I'm not going to do the colonoscopy on the air. I'm not Katie Korva. If I were Katie Korva, I'd spit in the jar on the air, and you'd hear the spittle go in. But I'll do it in the privacy of my own home and mail it in. Do not eat, drink, smoke, or chew gum for 30 minutes before collecting your spit. Do not remove the plastic film, blah, blah, blah. Then you spit it in, and you get a bag, you go in, and you wait 4 weeks, and you check a secure site. A secure site in the age of WikiLeaks? I'm going to have a secure ancestry site in the age of WikiLeaks run by the CIA? Yeah, right. Oh, by the way, speaking of WikiLeaks, the best thing written about it so far was by the old lion, Wes Pruden of the Washington Times, who was the editor-in-chief emeritus of the Washington Times. Editor emeritus of the Washington Times. I love Wesley Pruden's writing. Here's what he wrote, one paragraph about WikiLeaks. He writes, so far we've seen and heard nothing explode except for a few soggy firecrackers, like rude noises in a church pew. A few editors, notably at the New York Times, are posing as heroes of the free world, but it's only a pose. The leaker Julian Assange, an Australian, is painted as James Bond, but he's more like, well, in the apt description of one anonymous internet blogger, quote, a little boy playing at being a mystery hero, and like so many of the childish left, he is utterly bewitched by his sense of self-importance, close quote. See, now that's what you call journalism. That's what you call journalism. We have so little of it. And boy, do we need a lot of it. Has anyone out there had their DNA tested? Would you recommend that others spit in the jar and get their DNA tested? Your health, your ancestry? I'm actually interested more than in my health because I know about my risk factors to a certain extent. At a certain point, I'm not interested anyway. I'm doing everything I could possibly do short of taking Lipitor, which I won't take because it made me almost a cripple. Because I know, obviously, my body doesn't need it. Trace your ancestral lineage. I like this. This is interesting. Who is it going to turn out I'm related to? Immerse yourself in the lives of your ancestors. Did they paint bison in the caves of northern Spain? I doubt it. Did they invent agriculture in the Middle East? I doubt it. I think they sold antiques in the Stone Age. I probably had an antique dealer in the Bronze Age. Fine. No, because my father was really expert in bronzes, and I picked that up from him. It must have something to do with the Bronze Age. I don't know. Find out if you share an ancestral path with a celebrity. Oh, wow. Just think, I might be related to Bonnie Frank. Experts have traced the ancestral lineages of several well-known people, finding out if your DNA connects you to a select group of such celebrities, such as Marie Antoinette, I never liked her ice cream, Thomas Jefferson, Warren Buffett, and Bono. You hear they put Bono in the same class as Thomas Jefferson. I know already the company's run by wackadoos. I can see that already. See the history passed on from generation to generation. With state-of-the-art tools, we trace everyone's maternal ancestry with a small piece of DNA passed down from mother to child. Males can uncover their paternal ancestry through the Y chromosome that is passed down from father to son. Well, how are they going to test my dad? He kind of left the world in 1970. Discover your unique history from over 750 maternal lineages and over 500 different paternal lineages. Each lineage is accompanied by a story detailing the adventures of your ancestors. I don't know that I want this exposed. Carefully curated by our scientists. That's a hilarious line. The adventures of your ancestors. Watch your ancestors being chased by Cossacks. See your ancestors being set on fire. I can't wait to see this one. I am interested in this to a certain extent. It'll probably turn out I'm related to Obama somewhere. I know that's what's coming, which I could live with. But what if it turns out I'm related to Bonnie Frank? I don't know if I could live that one down. If it turns out there's any DNA between me and Bonnie Frank, I'm leaving radio. I'll be right back.
Savage. need to be clear about what the right wing is saying. We care so much about the deficit that we can't extend unemployment for people who are out of work, although some of them have this ideological view that it's just lazy people, and if you make their children suffer enough, they'll stop hanging out at the beer parlor and go get a job, apparently.
Who wears short shorts?
Oh, Bonnie. Bonnie, you care so much about the little guy, don't you, Bonnie? That's why you ran Fannie and Freddie. So that the poor, the average person, can just go to any bank and get whatever they want. What a bunch of... So Obama went to Afghanistan. Now, he didn't meet President Hamid Karzai while he was there, but he spoke to him on the telephone. Now, what I don't understand is why he had to go to Afghanistan to speak to Karzai by telephone. Does he not understand there's long distance? Symbol shot. 1-800-44. So here it is. I'm going to get my DNA, discover the heritage in your genes. Where in Africa or Europe did your ancestors live? If you're European, we can pinpoint what populations your DNA is most similar to. Do you have Native American ancestry? Multiple insights into your family origins. That's interesting to me because I had a background in anthropology at a certain graduate school, graduate level with a very... very intense interest in that. I'm very interested in ethnicity and origins. And I'm really bewildered because in my case, I'm like nobody I know of my alleged allele group. Let's put it to you that way. That's sort of, you know, that's well put. I don't know anyone of my alleged allele group who I'm like. I'm sort of an outlying genetic statistic, and I don't understand it. The only thing I can figure out, and I know I'm not adopted. That I'm pretty sure I was, and I have certain traits of both parents physical, so I know that I'm, you know, saying no matter what. But I think that somewhere along the way, there must have been somebody who visited one of the villages. I don't know how to put it exactly. During a pillage, this, I don't know, there was either some Viking invasion or something happened to explain how I'm different than my supposed allele cousins. Anyway, let's go to the callers. Larry in San Diego, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Well, Michael, good Shabbos. What I called about is earlier in the week you mentioned something about having dreams. This is the week that during the Parsha that we're reading and across the world, all Jews are reading, where Pharaoh had the dreams of the cattle being, the cows being eaten by the...
Wait, hold it. Larry, I appreciate your intense knowledge of the Bible. Let's start again. What does my dream have to do with what you are discussing, please?
Well, the fact of the dreams, that you had dreams and you wouldn't understand why you're having dreams. I'm just saying it's related. This, of all the weeks to have dreams that come up to you or they mean something, here the dreams of Pharaoh.
Larry, I have dreams every night that mean something. So you're trying to take the fact that I expressed some dreams on the air and you just simply want to read the portion of the Torah that you're reading tomorrow. So give me a 10-second version of it. What is it about?
It was about Joseph being released from the prison.
Joseph being released from the Pharaoh, yes?
Yep, from the prisons to run Pharaoh's whole nation and the whole world for 14
years. Oh, now that's interesting. That's very interesting. Now, how did Joseph get released by the Pharaoh?
He was, because one of the cupbearer remembered that Joseph gave him the answer to his dream, and he also gave the dream to the baker. The baker got hung, the cupbearer got released to reserve Pharaoh. And 2 years later, he remembered, because no one could answer Pharaoh's dreams, what they were. So he remembered that his dream was told by Joseph. So he brought him out of the prison, cleaned him up, and he went and told Pharaoh what the dreams meant.
But why was Joseph in prison to begin with? Who imprisoned him and why?
Potiphar, his wife, claimed that Joseph tried to take her, the seducer, while he was alone with her in the house, when it wasn't true, when he was running Potiphar was the butcher for Pharaoh, and his wife...
Wait a minute, Joseph worked for the Pharaoh, and they say that he tried to shtup the Pharaoh's wife?
No, she was the butcher's wife trying to shtup her, but he wasn't actually shtupping her. She made it...
I don't understand. Well, what was he doing for the Pharaoh? He was a baker, a butcher? What was Joseph?
Joseph was brought in by the people who found him in the hole when his brothers threw him in a hole. They wanted to get rid of him. So
in other words, like putting a man in an old age home today in Boca Raton.
It could be, except they give him...
Okay, all right. So he winds up working for the Pharaoh, and now the Pharaoh hears he tried to like get funny with the wife.
No, the Pharaoh found out that he could read dreams, and the cupbearer had told him. He remembered him from prison, and they brought him from the prison to Pharaoh. And
I can read dreams. I've been doing dream interpretation since I'm 17. So he got pardoned by the Pharaoh. You know that Obama pardoned 9 people, including 4 cocaine dealers. You know that?
No.
Oh, yeah, 9 of them got released. Do you think, by the way, it's an interesting political question. Do you think that any American should have the right to be pardoned by a president? What happened to the issue of fair justice? If you can just be pardoned, if you can buy your way up to the presidency, how does that work?
If lawyers are liars, is it the same thing? You know,
half the people that Bill Clinton pardoned and then Bush pardoned, I think, are now working for Obama.
Did Bill Clinton go with Eric Holder on that trip so they could have time to talk to each other about what the next plan is?
I haven't any idea. Larry, I want to thank you for your kind and loving discourse today. I still don't know what Obama's doing in Afghanistan. I don't know why he would go there. They go to the troops, sure, but you know he's anti-military. Well, he's doing something to do with the WikiLeaks. He wants to get out of the country right now. And also, there's got to be something behind the scenes going on. That he wouldn't meet Karzai makes good sense because he's afraid of, you know, a terrorist incident. No question about that. Plans for a face-to-face meeting with Karzai were abruptly scrapped. That's clever because obviously they got some warning. And I don't blame him. I wouldn't meet Karzai. I wouldn't even eat break lamb with him, I'll tell you the truth. I wouldn't eat a lamb chop with Karzai. I don't think Karzai's brother-in-law would eat, you know, lamb stew with him. The White House and Afghan blamed the last-minute cancellation on rough weather. The U.S. military couldn't fly him in. Guys who could fly an F-21 strike airplane in the middle of a hurricane couldn't fly the president into a dinner with Karzai. Well, I guess they think that we really are idiots because I don't understand this.
Savage.
I don't need to tell you, this is a tough fight. I just came from the medical unit and saw our wounded warriors pin some Purple Hearts. I just talked to the platoon that lost six of their buddies in a senseless act of violence. This is tough business. Progress comes slow. There are going to be difficult days ahead. Progress comes at a high price.
You can't mock this. You see, here's what's going to happen. This is what happens to everyone who becomes president. They start out in one way or another, and they go and see guys who are 100 times better than them, and they look in their faces, and they see the dead and the wounded, and they come back a different man, a changed man. And this is what's happening to Obama. I can tell you I'm an expert at voices. And he was visibly affected by those in the hospital, as anyone would be who has a heart and a soul. And the fact of the matter is he's going to come back a changed man. He might become an American at the end of the day who cares about America and American values. The problem is we can't afford a president on training wheels anymore who's still, using some of the rhetoric that he learned in college along the way. But that's what we're stuck with. So let's go back to the ancestry thing, the DNA testing I'm going to get. I'm not so sure I want to spit in the jug and send it to these women who run it. I'm looking at the board of directors. I don't know who they are. How do I know if they're not moles for the CIA? And they get my DNA? I mean, really, do you want to do this? Has anyone done this yet? Has anybody out there spit in the jar? San Diego, Mike, have you done this? Don't name the company, but have you done this thing where you spit in the jar and find out your ancestry?
Yeah, Michael, I use the biggest one out there with the largest database to compare against.
What happened?
I was adopted at birth, so I didn't even know that my dad's side was Jewish until I did the test. Found some relatives, found out that we all go back to an ancient Egyptian man who probably became Jewish at some point. And
Wait, you're telling me it's that specific they can tell you the name of the guy in Egypt that was your ancestor?
Not the name, but they can pinpoint the fact that we resemble about half the men in southern Egypt, and it's a very rare...
So his name was like Murray, and he owned a pickle shop somewhere in Cairo in 10... How does this work?
It just happened to be that they've they've divided up all of these different DNA subclades on the male side and the Y DNA, and it's all sort of done by geography and population genetics, where you can really tell where your original paternal ancestor came from.
So how would they test your Y chromosome inheritance? Since if your father's not known, how would they do that?
Just because I found another relative in their database who I almost matched perfectly with just like a third cousin. And
so I'm going to find out some of my relatives through this, like we're current relatives or going back a couple hundred years.
It would probably be within a few generations back, because otherwise you would already know the person.
Yeah, well, the only relatives I know I don't speak to, so I don't know how this is going to work.
Well, you could have some fifth cousins or something that might have came over to New York, too, or some other area in the U.S., or it might still be in Europe. You can just find out.
And where did so you found out that your paternal ancestry goes back to Egypt?
Right, yeah. And we're Eastern European Jews on that side, so it's continuous from ancient.
And you were adopted and did not know that you had any such ancestry? That's an interesting story, Mike.
Yeah, I had. I just knew that I was Czech on that side. I didn't realize it was Czech Jews. I just thought they were.
So the folks who adopted you, what was their ethnicity?
Mix of everything, really, other than African American. So yeah.
This is a strange question and not meant to challenge you nor to embarrass you, but were they at all? Did they have any anti-Semitism prior years ago? Did you hear anything that was anti-Semitic along the way?
Actually, once in a while I did, but not from my parents, from other, not relatives really, just from other people just growing up.
The reason I ask is because it would be intriguing to see what happens when a man thinks that he hates a particular race, and then he does his test and finds that he's got the same blood or partially the same genetic inheritance, rather.
Yeah, I actually heard a story about two Polish neo. Did you tell this story? Actually, it was two Polish neo Nazis.
Yeah. And then they found out they're partly Jewish. That story.
Right. And there was
What I'd like to do is, if they could find a piece of Hitler's bones, which don't exist, I'd love to see what that's about. With all the rumors about him.
Yeah, they actually just they compared. They did actually found out what Hitler's DNA was. And
How could they do that if he was burned by the Russians?
They found one of his paternal side cousins that lives in like New Jersey or someplace.
Really?
Like, yeah, a couple months ago, and it's like Mediterranean in origin, but probably like a Roman, not like Semitic, so to speak. Probably some sort of Roman ancestry going back a long time, which is fairly common in Austria because it's pretty close to Mediterranean.
Pretty amazing stuff. I mean, look, you know, we're entering a brave new world here with this genetic testing, truthfully, and it's very intriguing. But did you ever fear perhaps that your DNA profile would be somehow leaked or someone could get a hold of it?
Yeah, actually, I know that the database is like sort of a blind database. You just see numbers, and if someone doesn't want to contact you, you don't have to let them know who you are or anything. But as far as their records are sealed, who knows if somebody can just break in and take them all? I'm sure pretty easily over the internet with hacking and all that.
Well, I'm looking at the scientific advisors. They look like 99% left-wing wackadoos. This is the university today. They may be brilliant in their fields, but they may as well be Larry David or Woody Allen in terms of their political views. That's what I'm concerned about.
That's true. I know in France it's actually illegal to do any DNA testing unless the person would probably have to leave the country, I think, to be able to do it.
Is that right? That it's illegal to do this in France? That's amazing.
Yeah, it's like a black hole as far as the science. There's not really been the sort of population genetics.
Well, I don't blame them if they ever found out what they derived from, what population they derived from. It could be the end of France as we know it. I'm sorry. I couldn't resist that one. That was too easy. But France is an interesting conglomeration of tribes, of European tribes. It's a fascinating story unto itself. Fascinating, Mike. So at the end of the day, do you feel your life was enriched by the genetic test you took, or do you feel you were made somewhat vulnerable in a way and you feel strange? Would you recommend it, in other words?
Oh, I would recommend it. I thought it was very interesting. It was good to talk to somebody who I'm related to by blood for the first time. And, I would definitely recommend it.
All right, Mike, I'm sending you trickle-up poverty for no reason other than you need it. That's an amazing story. Well, I'm going to let you know what I, you know, the diseases, all right. I don't know that I really want to know the disease, you know, proclivities, truthfully. What do I need to know what I already know? What I don't know what the disease proclivities are. I don't know who died when. I do. I know exactly what I inherited. Every breath is a miracle to me. I don't think I felt I wouldn't be here for 20 years. I didn't think I'd make it this far. So map the heritage in your genes. To me, each day is a miracle, to be honest with you. In that sense, I'm a religious man, when you think about it. See, I know it's not in my hands at this point. I mean, yeah, of course it is. I mean, I could kill myself, God forbid, or, you know. But grow your family tree like never before. Map the heritage in your, play some rock and roll, and I'll come back. Not through a break, though. I'm not taking a break. Dream is good. All right. Oh, there was an interesting story. Keep playing that for a minute. To me, fascinating. On michaelsavage.com, I got it from the New York Post. I could knock it off now. Thank you. Thank you. You remember the movie The Godfather from 72? Who doesn't remember it? And remember the Tudor house that they allegedly lived in Long Beach behind the gates? It's an offer you can't refuse. The family is selling the Godfather mansion, and guess where it is? It's in Staten Island on Tot Hill. I thought it was a fascinating story. I assumed all along it was Staten Island house and the Godfather up for sale. And it's a whole story. But you want to hear something weird? One Staten Island family is waiting for an offer they can't refuse. Now listen to this line. After nearly six decades of living at 110 Longfellow Avenue, the Norton family is selling their home, or as legions of moviegoers better knew it, the Corleone clan's sprawling estate in The Godfather. It was amazing to me because I grew up at 829 Longfellow Avenue, not in Staten Island, but in the Bronx. All the streets in that slum that I grew up in were named for the English poets. Longfellow, above me was Bryant. Who was the man who laid out those tenements that I grew up in and came up with those names of Longfellow and Bryant Avenue and all of those names of famous writers? I mean, what did that have to do with those slum houses, those slum apartment buildings? Of course, they weren't slums when I lived there. They were clean. They were poor, but everybody's house, you could eat off the floor. Immaculate. Immaculate. No one said I lived in a slum, therefore I'll ruin it. The houses were immaculate. Then when we all left and they moved in the welfare jobs, what you call Section 8 today, they set their mattresses on fire, threw them off the fire escape, threw their children out of the windows because there wasn't enough government support, not enough government welfare. You know what I mean? How's that part? How does that work? How is it the inhabitants of these so-called slum tenements lived in peace and harmony? No one got murdered. No one got shot. The place was clean. There was family solidarity. There was a sense of community. The women sat down in front of the buildings with their carriages out in the sun. The children played in the street. Cars slowed down for the kids. How did it happen that all of a sudden, when that generation left, the next one that came along wasn't exactly up to par? How'd that happen? Is that because the society didn't provide them with adequate housing? Is that because the government didn't give them a job and a meal and a welfare job? I guess you don't like hearing any of this. It makes you uncomfortable. And I'll tell you something else. A lot of what I, you know, my background in New York, what I just described to you, is similar to millions upon millions of people across this country. The descendants of European immigrants who worked as hard as they could to educate their children, never stepped out of line, and produced everything that we're enjoying in this country today to the 90th percentile. And then all of a sudden we wake up and others busting in from everywhere else. And right away they tell you, give me this, give me that. You owe me this, you owe me that. I'm going to sue. I want a Dream Act. Give me a free education. I didn't have a free education. I worked two jobs to go to college. How come I didn't need a Dream Act? It would have made my life a little easier. But guess what? I didn't expect it to be easier. I was told it's a hard road. Didn't hurt me to work harder. What's the big deal? What I need to give them a Dream Act for? Let them do what I did. Let them work three jobs and raise children and go to school. I'm sick of this country the way it's being run by these whack job left-wingers, but I don't mean to get off the topic here. You got the point. You start me with ancestry, and I'll tell you the whole truth and nothing but the truth. So help me, God. I'll be right back. Well, then there's news to talk about in the Savage Nation. There's so much news, I don't know if I even want to read it. It's Friday. I'd rather listen to rock and roll music. But do you really want to hear the news? I mean, I can go to the websites. I can tell you what I found. The stories are UN proposal to prosecute the U.S. for ecocide. The United Nations has come up with another rule or a plan to sanction governments that engage in ecocide, which is defined as crimes against biodiversity, nature, and Mother Earth. So if you spat out your window on Mother Earth, a black helicopter is liable to come down from the Bolivian sky. They're going to make ecocide the equivalent of a war crime or a crime against peace. And it can only be applied against people in developed countries. Now, this idea did not originate in Bolivia, but in the United Kingdom, the same place that I've been banned from entering. It's the brainchild of labor lawyer turned green lunatic Polly Higgins. Some supporters want to prosecute climate deniers who oppose actions to combat global warming as eco-criminals. Now you understand what the UN is about. It's worldwide communism, and that the whole scam of global warming is an attempt to turn us into a worldwide police state. They want us to pay $1 billion to Haiti because we caused the floods. We caused the floods. That's what we did it, not nature. So be careful now if you're anti-nature and anti-Mother Earth, that you may be prosecuted for ecocide by your friends on the Upper East Side in the UN. Turns out Russia is still doing what it has always done, which is threaten us. Nothing's changed. That unless we pass the START Treaty, which of course is the death of the U.S. national security establishment, they're going to build U.S. approval, a step toward Russian company control of Wyoming uranium mines. Two uranium mines in Wyoming are on their way to control by a Russian company now that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has approved transferring the mines' licenses. Meh, what the heck? Somebody made money off it. Why should it matter if a few guys in Washington made money on this? And that you don't really care if a Russian company owns the Stillwater Mining Company in Montana, the only producer of palladium and platinum in the USA. Why shouldn't the government let the highest bidder get it? It's the way of capitalism. It's the free market. It's what Rush Limbaugh calls for. It's what all of those people on the idiot right believe is the way we should run our country, which is the free market concept. And if the Russians bid the most for the only producer of palladium and platinum in the USA, they should get it. It was the same with the Defense Department, according to Rush Limbaugh and others on the idiot right. If let's say, China can run our military at a more cost-effective way than Robert Gates, they should run the military. I mean, they could provide better uniforms at a lower price. They could feed our boys, let's say, a handful of rice every day instead of a meal provided by Halliburton at $16 a tray. I mean, why shouldn't the troops be fed one handful of rice instead of a tray? That's the free market, isn't it, Rush? Let the free market reign. Give the boys a handful of rice and Kool-Aid in Afghanistan. If they don't like it, well, I guess they can always do nothing. And that's the way it is. There's nothing saying they're entitled to a tray of food prepared by Halliburton or Howard Johnson. I don't know who makes the food. And then we get billed $16 a tray. If the boys go back for a second helping, you get billed another $16. The age of a guy cooking in the Army is over. The age of a guy doing laundry in the Army is over. You wouldn't want to have women in the military doing the cleaning, would you? No, that would be racist or someist. I don't know what it would be. So the government continues to sell off our most precious natural resources. And we sit here like dummies arguing over nothing. 1-800-449-8255. Watching the world go around. Stop Obama from destroying our national security. Read how in trickle-up poverty. It's ahead of the curve. I realize it's not for the average person. Remember the Panasonic ads in the late 60s, slightly ahead of our time? That's how I feel I am, slightly ahead of my time. See, if you're too far ahead of your time, then you're considered insane and you wind up in a hospital, probably as a psychiatrist. But if you're just slightly ahead of your time, you can be a good talk show host. I'm sorry. I'm supposed to have a good time doing radio. That's what I read somewhere when I first started in radio. I mean, people all say to me, So the people I actually talk to, which are like very few, have a good show. What the heck does a good show mean? What do you mean have a good show? How do you have a good show? That's like saying have a good childbirth. You know a woman who ever said she had a good childbirth? Her whole body was ripped apart by it. She's relieved that that mass is out of her body. That's like a radio show. Same thing. There's no such thing as a good show. You can get giddy and idiotic, of course, and think you did a good show, and then you're on the road to perdition. There's no question about that. Lots of people in this business think they're doing great shows, and they wake up and they have zero ratings, and they're out of business, and they don't have a syndicator, and they're doing weekends. That's what the business is all about. That's how you mark how you are. It's not about how many stations you have. It's hard to say how you judge where you are in this business. Can I say one thing now, because it's already it's the 3rd of December. Can I just say thank you to this audience? Maybe I'm a little too self-centered. I admit it. I'm a little too self-centered. It's hard not to be in radio because you're alone in a room. But, you know, I told you, I did not know where I stood with regard to you, my listener, until this book came out on October 5th. I had tremendous trepidation that trickle-up poverty wouldn't do great. I didn't know if the audience was really there in the numbers that they used to be. I started to believe the haters. You don't know what a beating I've taken since they did this to me in England. You have no idea the toll it's taken on me. But I am a fighter. I didn't give in. I kept fighting. I'm still here, and I'm not sure England is still here. But I want to thank you again from the bottom of my heart for supporting me.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Is the Savage Nation Rock and Roll Friday. You made it through another week. TGIF. Now you have two big days to ponder your failures in life until Monday when you go back to a job that you don't know if it'll be there on Tuesday. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Just keep on laughing. That's all I can say. Keep on whistling in the dark. Things are going to get better. Happiness is just around the corner. Just ask Obama. He's going to bring back pita bread from Afghanistan. Why he'd fly around the world, halfway around the world, and not visit the leader of the country over there, but speak to him by telephone? I mean, they don't have long-distance service in the White House? I don't understand that one. But then again, there's a lot of things I don't understand about this president. Here we are on the Savage Nation. I have a lot of many things I want to talk about right now that have almost nothing to do with the news. In the last hour, I talked about the fact that I'm going to get my DNA tested. I'm spitting in a test tube. I'm going to send it in. We talked about Ancestry. People have been calling in about that. You know, I've had a tremendous year. Thank God. It's been an amazing year for me. The publication of Trickle Up Poverty and its great success, with virtually no help from the media, tells me that my audience today on radio is stronger than it's ever been. See, I don't need ratings to tell me this, and I don't need polls or the number of affiliates. That's not the best judge to me. The best judge is how many folks went out, motivated themselves to go into a bookstore and get the book and fight for it when it wasn't there, and it's awesome what's happened. Now, that's not behind me, but, you know, I'm like a rolling stone. I never stop. Not only is that book finished, and not only am I working on my next nonfiction book, I'm also working on a novel, and have been for a while, that St. Martin's is going to publish in the summer. And it's a thriller. You're not going to believe it. All I can give you is a one-liner. I was working on it all day today. My fictionalized account of being banned from Britain and hunted by overbearing governments is set in the San Francisco only I know. This will be my most exciting book yet. And the publisher said this, and this is very interesting. St. Martin said, Michael Savage is one of the most influential voices in American politics. His radio show, his website, and his best-selling nonfiction books are hugely popular and widely quoted. What I didn't know before, he wrote, but see clearly now, is Savage has that same ability to fashion a good action-packed thriller that is sure to please his legions of fans. It's true. I'm already envisioning the movie. See, I can't wait to see the movie made in San Francisco because there's scenes, there's street scenes I know about this city that I'm, of course others know the city, but there's a way I know it that's unique to me. I know the way the light looks on certain walls in this city in certain months that I've never seen portrayed in films. In that sense, I have a palette of color that's never been portrayed in a film adequately. It doesn't mean there haven't been great movies shot in San Francisco. There have been. I know back alleys. I know restaurants. I know where the best windows with mortadella are. I know where the best chickens hanging in Chinese grocery stores are. Every one of these scenes is incredible for a movie. Background, you know? And this goes back to The Godfather, filmed in that house in Staten Island that's up for sale now, the family owned up there. Same thing. I mean, the background of this movie. I know islands in the Bay of San Francisco that you never heard of that are going to be part of this. So anyway, I was working on the book today, contemplating the year 2011, and I contemplated what happened to me this year. I had a listener. He may be listening right now. His name is Vernon from Oakland. And he is a palm reader. I know many of you are religious and you don't believe in such things, but that's your problem. Just as there are many people who are atheists who don't believe in religion, what are you going to do, dismiss all of them too? See, I think it's a big world and there are many ways to arrive at the truth and what's really going on, not just one way. I know that flies in the face of people who are devoutly religious, but so be it. I'm only a talk show host. I'm not a religious personality, so forgive me for my limitations in this regard. So Vernon had sent me an analysis out of the blue about 6 months ago, and I just found it again. I put it on a wall in my apartment in San Francisco. I hadn't been in there for a long time. I go in there, and the wall, it said, 2011 will be the year where most of what you've worked for in the last few years will be fulfilled, which I thought was astounding. And I hope it's true, because there's only so much a man is willing to take in the world until he walks away and says goodbye and good night and good luck. But I'm believing 2011 will turn out to be a good year. I'm hopeful it will be. And I pray about it every day in my own little way. I don't go to a formal place for prayer. If you do, I respect you for it. I think that you carry the traditions that are required for religion to survive through time. But I don't. I mean, just during the break, I went outside of the studio with a little prayer book that my long deceased maternal grandmother gave to me when I was 13 years of age, a little white prayer book. I've carried it all over the world. I've had this little book in Fiji, Tonga, Samoa, the Marquesas. I've had it from the top of mountains. I've had it everywhere, boats. It's a little prayer book that you can conduct every kind of service known to mankind that's necessary, whether it be morning services or a prayer upon someone dying, or a blessing, or a marriage, or a grace before meals, or after meals, rather, a prayer before retiring at night, and things of that nature, marriage service, and all of this. So I was thinking about it, how powerful prayer is, and how powerful prayer books can be, how powerful a little white book can be. I had no idea what it was when my grandmother gave it to me. I really didn't. I was a kid. I didn't know, but she was a very poor woman, spoke no English whatsoever, none. And she was so happy, and she gave me this little book, and I never touched it, really. I looked at it and said, thank you. A little white leather-bound prayer book. And later on, years later, I went and retrieved it from somewhere, and I've kind of carried it with me. Not every second, not everywhere I go, but it's in the background. Wherever I go, I know where it is. Sometimes I fly with it, and I know if you saw me on a plane, you'd think I'm an idiot, but I actually am one of those people who do a prayer on an airplane. I don't mean on my knees with fear, but I read a prayer when I get on an airplane, because it's still, to me, miraculous, flying. I'm not jaded. I'm not a jaded person. In that sense, perhaps I'm naive. I don't know, but I just still do. So it leads me to what I'm about to say to you. So in 2011, God willing, I should survive that long, I hope. The novel comes out. another nonfiction book comes out the following year, then another novel comes out a year after that. I'm busier than I've ever been in my life. And the fact is that's the way I want it to be. I'm not planning on retiring. I'm not planning on sitting on a rocking chair or going sign. I don't want to go to Provence to get drunk. If I want to drink wine, I can go to my wine cellar. And if I want to eat cheese, I can go to a cheese store. And if I want good Italian food, I can go to Aliotto's tonight in San Francisco. What do I have to do? I mean, I don't. Okay, so in that sense, I'm sort of an old world personality. I got to tell you, I really am. I traveled so much when I was young. I didn't like traveling. I never liked traveling. Do you know that I can admit to you, I never liked traveling. I never liked flying. It wasn't that I was afraid of flying. I don't like confinement. I don't like the loss of control. As many, by the way, as many pilots. I'm not a pilot, but I'm similar in mentality to many pilots in some regards. Psychologically, they don't like the loss of control. I've had some fighter pilots call the show and say, I agree with you. There's many stories of pilots who, when their passengers are very anxiety-ridden because they're not in control. You have to have a very unusual personality to be a pilot to begin with, as you have to have a very unusual personality to be a surgeon, by the way, and you have to be a very unusual person in order to be a talk show host, by the way. These are not ordinary professions. You can put them in the same category in some regard, as in the same category you can put fighters, drummers. I've done the analysis, fighters, drummers, jet pilots, etc. Somehow are related psychologically, and I haven't done the study because I'm not an expert in the field. But anyway, the fact of the matter is 2011 should be an interesting year, not only for myself but for the nation, because we're coming into some very strange times with the communists closing the noose on us around the world, a president who was very much like a Chamberlain at best, a Pol Pot at worst in the White House. We have a very interesting year ahead of us, and let's pray to God that we have some loyal opposition in the White in the Congress that's going to stand up to these people who have taken us to this depth that we are in. So one of the things I was doing today was when I was thinking about the novel, I'm not going to talk much about it because I don't want to talk myself out, was I was thinking about this. There has not been a character in a book in so long. Well, let's go in another way. Do you remember movies that were out as near as 10 years ago where America was great and the good guys were Americans? Do you remember when there was like a war scene and high above the war scene there was an F-15 or an F-16 off an aircraft carrier, and you'd hear that particular American voice of a pilot, a fighter pilot, calling in before a bombing run to save some guys that were on the ground, and you viscerally in the movie theater, your whole heart leapt. You loved that voice. You remember that? You remember those movies where you hear that particularly American Midwestern voice of an American fighter pilot, and he's about to come in and kill the bad guys, blow them to hell where they belong, and save our boys? You remember those feelings? You haven't seen a movie like that recently, have you? And that's because Hollywood's run by the most despicable group of vermin we have ever seen in the history of that great institution that makes motion pictures. But I have a feeling that that's going to change in a very short period of time. And I hope I am part of that change, as I've been part of some other change, irrespective of whether I receive credit for it doesn't matter to me. But I'm going to continue to push this society in the direction I think it should go in order for us to survive and in order for it to be a better place. I'll be right back.
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation, Friday night. Friday night, all the youngsters are getting ready for something tonight. Sex, what do you think they're getting ready for? Everything's about sex. It's the way God set it up. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's the whole story. The strongest drive there is next to wanting an ice cream that you can't have. 1-800-449-8255, Michael Savage. Why is that the strong? Remember when you were in high school? And the teacher in biology would start talking about the strongest drives in man are the desire for water, food, reproduction. And the kids would turn red and embarrass and poke each other. Every time they said reproduction, it's amazing what kids are. Nothing changes, by the way. The kids are exactly the same, one generation after another. It's genetically encoded for it to be that way. And the drives are the same, obviously. Nothing's changed. You think everyone's different than you, or they're not any different. That's why the whole DNA testing is interesting to me. I mean, we're fundamentally Neolithic. We're the same as our Neolithic ancestors in so many ways, other than perhaps style. Other than that, biologically, we're the same as our Neolithic ancestors, which, of course, has been written about many different ways when it comes to nutrition, is that we're eating diets that are not at all, that we're not at all adapted for. We're not adapted for the modern American diet or the modern European diet whatsoever. We're adapted for a Neolithic diet. Diets, in other words, are the very, very distant ancestors that we may or may not be aware of. And what are those diets? I guess there's some ethnicity involved. There certainly is. I wrote a whole book about it 30 years ago. But I don't want to talk about food and diet. So boring. So clinically boring. It's like coprolites to me. You know, to me, it's like talking about coprolites. I remember I once met a guy years ago when I was in grad school. He was an interesting guy. He came back from Chiapas, Mexico. And I said, Michael, what are you studying? He said, coprolites. I said, what? I didn't even know what coprolites were. And he said, yeah, well, we went to certain ruins and we found the coprolites of ancient Aztecs, or Mayans, rather. So great. And I said, that's an interesting thing. And he was an ethnobotanist of some kind. I was in the same field, but not interested in coprolites. I was interested in medicinal plants, plants that cure, for example. Hey, different strokes for different folks. You know, if you're interested in the coprolites of ancient Mayans, good luck to you. I'm not quite interested in that kind of potty talk and scientific symposia. But, you know, people in science were always weird anyway. Most people in sciences should be weird. They shouldn't be like normal people. You've got to understand, people in science are supposed to be oddballs. If they're not, then what the heck are they doing in science? They're never going to accomplish anything. They're just technocrats. They may be brilliant. They may be brilliant technicians or brilliant technocrats. And that's, of course, the problem with our science today. It's become so grant-driven that the only people who can survive in science are those who are adept at getting grants. And what getting grants means is writing a proposal for a study that's probably not necessary, because it's just going to reconfirm what's already known, or reconfirm what a drug company wants confirmed, or reconfirm what a corporate sponsor wants confirmed. But the age of the Einstein sitting there with a pencil and a pad and just scratching out ideas and saying, I'd like to have this funded, is way over. It was over a long time ago. In fact, if Charles Darwin were alive, he couldn't get a job as a janitor in a junior high school. They wouldn't hire him. A, he's a white male. That's number one. That's the first strike against him. He's not an ethnic minority. He probably wouldn't be an illegal alien, where he'd be given a DREAM Act and a grant immediately and a lawsuit against somebody to get what he wanted. So that's the second strike against him. Third, his idea was quite original, irrespective of whether you believe in it. It was quite original. And it wouldn't be funded. You know, I got to tell you something that I remember from the age of Darwin. I was there personally. And he presents his ideas before, I think, the Royal Society of this or that. And the old men of science get up and say, Mr. Darwin, all that you have said that is old is true, and all that you have said that is new is false. And that's what they said to him at that time. And, of course, that's what's said in science at all times. Anybody who comes along with something truly revolutionary or truly new is usually castigated and called names, as is true in politics, as is true in art, as is true in virtually any creative field. Anything that is new is false to the establishment. So just give that some thought, and I'll be right back right here on the Savage Nation. Take your calls and entertain you.
Savage.
So as the world turns, I told you in the beginning of the show, one of the things I love in movies, because I'm working on the novel, is that sound in the movie. You know, where pilots, fighter pilots are in the air. Let's say our soldiers are in a really bad spot, and they're calling in an airstrike to save themselves, right? And all of a sudden you hear that crackle, and you see the F-16 in some of the older movies, or the one, the plane that knocks me on my, just knocks me out is the stealth. I still, to this day, I saw one of my, a B-2 come over the Indianapolis Raceway a couple of years ago when my son was sponsoring a race car. It was the most awesome sight I've ever seen in my life. It came out of nowhere. And all I ask is why the hell we don't have the men with the guts to use them and wipe the vermin off the planet. I'm sick of it. How's that? I pray every day that we'll get a leader one day who finally use the weaponry that we paid for and end this crap in Afghanistan and get it over with already. Teach them a lesson. Show them the power of America. And stop listening to these maniac leftists. Every day I scream about this in my heart. So anyway, that B-2 bomber comes in over the field. The entire Indianapolis Speedway, everyone starts to cheer. It just, you know, out of nowhere. So you go back to these movies that they used to make in Hollywood when they still had a scintilla of patriotism. Soldiers in trouble, calling an airstrike to save them. And then you hear that sound, the Midwestern voice of the pilots coming in to save them. And that voice, that John Wayne-like, those voices, have always stirred me. I'm going to write them into my novel. Go listen to this right now.
Okay, well, I've got a single target, 20 right, 15,000 feet. Range 20 miles.
Okay, class, got a single target, same for 31,000 feet.
And we are ready to play.
That's it, Charles, or we have more? Because I'd like to get more. Huh? You got more? Yeah, get me more. Get me more. You get me the stage version of that. These guys are real dead afferent because that's how they play it. In the real world, they play it that way. I mean, they're more deadpan than the actors. The actors do a better job of playing fighter pilots than the fighter pilots do at playing fighter pilots. You know what other scenes I've always loved are, I don't want to give it away because I know I have so many enemies in the world who are going to steal these things from me and put them in their own book. No, I'm not going to give you any free show advice or free book advice. One of the things I've always loved in movies is the roar of a jet overhead. Don't you love that? In a movie, you hear the sound of a, I don't care what it is, a 767 flying in over a highway about to land at JFK when you're on the Belt Parkway, for example. It's so awesome. It's so awesome, the sound of a plane. To me, it's not pedestrian. To me, it's miraculous. And it when you feel the thunder of a jet, even if it's a passenger jet, it still projects what we're all about in Western civilization. I love it. No, I don't want to be pushing a cart in the 1500s somewhere in Aztecville, if you don't mind. I have great respect, by the way, for people who can make stone walls. I do. In fact, I was riding my bicycle this morning, and I saw some illegal immigrants building a stone wall, and were doing a magnificent job. They were stonemasons. This was not an ordinary job. This was very fine brickwork of different colors. It was gorgeous. And all I thought as I zipped by on my bicycle was, just as some Italian families to this day take pride in their grandfather's work in building some of the great churches of the East Coast, you know, like your grandfather was a stonemason. Your grandfather built this church, and the kid doesn't even know what he's talking about because he's never seen anybody cut stone and lay one stone into the other. He can't even comprehend it in an age of a computer. He doesn't know what that even means. The kid can't cut a piece of wood. You gave him a saw and a wood, he couldn't construct a shelter. You gave him a hammer and a nail, he couldn't bang two 2x4s together. It's terrible, you know. So anyway, so I said to myself, as I saw these guys, these immigrants, making that wall today, I said, you know, I understand that they are just like the Italians who built the churches. I know that. There's no difference. But that's not the point, is it? The point is not that they're good human beings with a skill. The point is that the country is sinking. The lifeboat is going down. And there's just no money for the social services. Don't you get it? The liberals killed the goose that laid the golden egg, and now they're trying to say you're a racist because you don't want to pay for it anymore. I say to myself as I go by on the bicycle, all in the flash of an eye. Boston, Massachusetts, Ferris, you're on the Savage Nation on RKO. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Doc, did you ever get a thank you from someone that you that kind of astonished you because the thanks ought to be going in the other direction? When you thanked your audience a minute ago, I almost fell off my chair because it really goes in the other direction here, and we're in a war. And you've been a leader to us in this war. And in wartime, you know, the platoon leader has no obligation and seldom would thank the people in his platoon. A general, a good general, who's leading in the way that a good general leads, doesn't thank the people. That's not part of war. That's not part of the military life, as is some of these other things that are under scrutiny by the
Yeah,
Congress.
But I'm not at war in one regard. I'm a talk show host on a commercial set of radio stations, and it's much different than being at war in one regard. We are in a social war, there's no question about it, and we have saved the country by throwing 60 of the socialist vermin out, but it hasn't changed very much yet. The war is just starting. This war is not over. This war is just beginning, to take your analogy a step further. We have a lot of fighting to do in 2011 and 2012. If you think Obama and Pelosi and Reid have gone away, I know you don't think so. They've dug their heels in. They're getting worse than they were before. And who predicted they would? Me. I told you they'd come back and be worse than before. Because a cornered animal is even more vicious than an animal that isn't cornered.
You mentioned that you were like a rolling stone. You never stop. That's persistence. And that's the mark of a true leader. I think you're in denial, though, when you talk about this war not being over. I'm afraid this war is over. I hope I'm wrong. But I think we've lost this great nation.
Now, and, you think we lost it to the who? The Chinese? You think they won?
To the secular progressive left. We lost it from within. We didn't lose it to any Chinese. Who rottened us to the core? It was our own people.
Well, I agree with you. When you see Defense Secretary Gates, so-called, and so-called Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mullen, telling the troops that if they don't like the lifting of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, they can leave the military at a time that the boys are dying over there, you know that the rot has gone all the way to the top, to the fish head.
So don't tell me that this war is going on. This war has been lost, and I hope I'm wrong. But and you continue to fight it, and you continue to lead us in a...
Well, wait a minute. No war is lost until it's over, and this war is not over. I disagree with you. When the Germans invaded Stalingrad, which was a beautiful, advanced, modernistic city in Russia, the most advanced city in Russia, have you ever seen pictures of Stalingrad before Hitler destroyed it? Have you ever seen those movies? It's astonishing. Modern plazas, people walking around looking just like they do up there on the Charles River in Boston, just like we do. And Hitler wanted to destroy it because it was called Stalingrad. It was named for his nemesis. And destroy it he did. He wrecked it. He killed millions of people. But you know, Stalingrad, they could have given up and said, all is lost. Our city is ruined. Did the Russians give up? They didn't give up. The Russians fought back. And then the winter came, and then they encircled the surviving German army, and the rest is history. No, the war isn't over, Ferris. I disagree with you 100%. We haven't even begun to fight. All we did was vote and throw out some of the socialist bums. I don't believe this battle has even begun yet.
Well, I have not given up. Don't get me wrong. But I'm afraid.
Well, you're sounding full of... You're like you're despairing. But... I don't know why you would think we have to all of a sudden throw in the towel because you think the secular vermin are running everything. It doesn't mean that they represent the people. They represent themselves. When you see these people and the kind of movies they produce and the kind of news that they put out and the constant anti-American, anti-family, anti-church, anti-God, anti-children, I can go down the list, garbage that comes out of Hollywood, which I call the sewer pipe of Hollywood. Of course you can get despairing, but that's not America. You think I don't get sick when I turn on Cops and I see the kind of the lowlifes that the cops have to deal with? The human garbage that they have to pick up every day? That every day we have millions of people who don't get up and go to work? All they do is collect a welfare check, and then they either beat up their wife, or they throw a child out of a window, and the cops have to go in there and risk their lives, and if, God forbid, the cops do it a little too good, the vermin in the ACLU sue the cop. You think it doesn't make me sick? It does.
Well,
I have to get up every day, and I have to look at things in a different way than you do. I have to look at things that are interesting, and I hope to God that the interest and the inspiration lifts America up and moves us forward.
Well, how dare
I'm sending you a cheerful present. I'm sending you trickle-up poverty to make you really happy. We have some actual dog fight sounds now. Are we ready, Charles? Let's listen to them.
Okay, Cole, I'm going to put him on the side of my scope to avoid the Fox 1 going left. Eyes open. He should be right behind us.
Okay, here he's going to go right below us now. Tally who he wants.
Okay, we've got a short tally 1, Fox 1.
Where? What war was this? Vietnam chase. Well, I guess it sounds better on YouTube than it does here. But anyway, you get the picture. We will we'll get the right actor's voice to do that in my movie. You know, we'll get the script where it sounds like a pilot when it really isn't. The real pilot sounds like that, but a movie pilot sounds like what you think is a real pilot, but it isn't. That's the magic of the movies. But you know what I'm talking about. When that plane comes over and the troops look up and they know their lives are going to be saved and the bad guy is like engulfed in flame. Isn't that what we're talking about? And the good guys go home for Thanksgiving turkey. Yeah, that's what we're talking about. And the liberals can go you know where, because I don't give a damn what they think anymore. I can't stand any one of them. They're like viruses to me. They're nothing but human viruses, what they've done to this country. So don't get me started, or I'll let the rage and the bile come up from the depths, and it won't happen. It won't be very good radio, see? Texas, Max, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
I'm with you on the miracle of flight. Many a Sunday afternoon when they divert traffic out of Houston Intercontinental Airport over my house about 40 miles away, I'll sit out there, drink a cold beer, and watch the different planes come over. It's a miracle, 747s. Occasionally, you'll see the big one, the Anatop 225, the Tommy flying tank. Six engines, 32 wheels. It's just great.
Wait, what is this plane, six engine? What is the plane?
It's an Anatop. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. Somebody will correct me if I'm not, but it's a 225. It's the world's biggest cargo plane. The nose flips up. It squats down like a happy cat. And you feed it through the neck. It's got a crane on board. Typically, it carries a lot of oil field equipment between.
Oh, it's a Russian transport, a Tupolev.
It's a commie plane. You know, the commies built them to build planes typically to fly forever. They're just over-engineered. They're flying tanks. And just twice in the past 2 years, this thing has flown over. You get the drone of the six engines, you know it's a big.
Well, wait, what is it delivering in Houston? What is it delivering over there?
You know, flies all over the world, but mainly it picks up oil field equipment, real high dollar. They've got to have it now, and off they go, and they fly all sorts of freight. You could put Greyhound buses inside this thing. It's so
wow. Crazy. Wow. So it's like the spruce goose come to life.
Absolutely, except this is Redbird. Let me tell you, when those six engines drone over your house at 2,000 feet, you run outside like a chicken. You put your head up and you just go, how in the heck is that thing flying?
Yep. Yeah, well, the miracle of flight is what we're talking about. Max, thank you for the call. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Come along and be my hearty doll. Come along and be my hearty doll. Come along and be my hearty doll. I'll make love to you. I'll make love to you. Well, I saw a...
It is the Savage Nation Rock and Roll Friday. Oh, these old hicks could really play, man. They could come up with songs you can't believe. Whatever happened to them? They all become crack addicts? All they can do is put out, like, disjointed... Representative Bonnie Frank. I got to hear some Bonnie Frank. Listen to what our country's become. This is an actual congressman. Listen.
We need to be clear about what the right wing is saying. We care so much about the deficit that we can't extend unemployment.
All right. Take a walk. All right. Thank you. That's a U.S. congressman, if you can believe this. This is what America's become. Then we have the ex-speaker of the House, who's more vehemently insane than before. Well, it's Nancy Pelosi. What can you say about Nancy Pelosi? The words themselves should become a verb rather than a name. You know, doing a Nancy.
Insurance, the economists tell us, return $2 for every dollar that is put out there for unemployment insurance. People need the money. They spend it immediately for necessities. It injects demand into the economy. It creates jobs to help reduce the deficit.
That's like saying people on welfare spend the money on necessities. It turned out in California a few months ago, they did a study, something like $62 million of it was found in gambling casinos in Las Vegas, gambling casinos in Hawaii, if there are any. I don't know what a gambler, Indian gambling casinos. Have you ever seen the people using food stamps and what they're buying with it? Do you have any idea what kind of scams are produced because of this? These government programs, you have any idea what we've become? A bloated ex-Soviet-like nation, which is why we're collapsing from within. The corruption, my God. Nancy, wake up. No one believes a word you say. Even in San Francisco, they've given up listening to you. Anyway, here we are. What do you want to talk about? We got so much to talk about and so little time. And bashing liberals, you know, it has its limits. Because today we all know who they are, and they bash themselves every time they speak. What amazes me, though, is that do they really know that everyone's laughing at them? It's like the movie Freaks by Todd Browning, where the freak, you know, says, everyone's laughing. Don't they know that people are laughing at them? Doesn't Pelosi and Frank and Reid know that people are laughing at them? Do they actually believe anybody believes them? No, I don't think so. I think they're in another world. They have no idea what happened. The election was like, what, a few weeks ago? 70 of their cohorts were thrown out. America has said no to socialism. America has said no to these government programs. America has said no to trickle-up poverty as a policy. And here we go again. She wants to push more unemployment insurance. He wants to push the DREAM Act for illegal aliens. Bonnie Frank wants to push more unemployment insurance because he's for the little people. That's why he runs Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Because he's for the little people. He's for the children. He cares about the little people, which is why he steered money to his supporters. You get the picture. We don't have to elaborate. So as the show began today, we began with Helen Thomas defending her hateful anti-Jewish remarks that led to her being fired by the Hearst Corporation. She's 90 years old. And Helen Thomas doesn't realize that at a certain point the jig is up. She has been unmasked for what she has been all of her life. And, of course, all those who tittered at her remarks all along should be ashamed of themselves. But, as you well know, the liberals have no shame. If they were capable of shame, they would no longer be liberal. If they actually understood what they stand for, which is the most vile anti-Americanism the world has ever seen, the nation has ever seen, they would cease being what they are. So she gives a speech today to a group of Arabs in Detroit, and she says that the Zionists control everything in America. No question about that, she says. Congress, the White House, Hollywood, Wall Street, owned by the Zionists. Now, she doesn't realize that this blood libel is what led to the death camps, or perhaps she does realize that this blood libel is what led to the death camps. And, of course, she's not banned in Brooklyn, nor is she even banned in the Catskill Mountains. I would think that after this diatribe against Jews, at least Helen Thomas should be banned from Monticello. She should not be allowed to go to Monticello, New York, after remarks like this. But look, that's how the world is. I was banned from England for remarks I didn't even make. And here's Helen Thomas, free to go to Katz's Delicatessen in Manhattan and have a corned beef on rye. Go figure how the world works. It's all politics. That's all it is. And let's all drink to a great 2011. Remember, the world is not over yet. We haven't lost the war. We've just begun to fight. We threw 60 of them out. Wait till 2012. Just wait. This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Warning, the Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Listen up.
I don't need to tell you, this is a tough fight. I just came from the medical unit and saw our wounded warriors pin some Purple Hearts. I just talked to the platoon that lost six of their buddies in a senseless act of violence. It's tough business. Progress comes slow. There are going to be difficult days ahead. Progress comes at a high price.
If I could take you up in paradise up above, if you would tell me I'm the only one that you love, life could be a dream, sweetheart. Hello, hello again, shaboom, and hoping we'll meet again. Oh, life could be a dream.
What's been going on in the news, the world of news? Let's see. Obama traveled to Afghanistan to thank the troops and canceled a face-to-face meeting with our man in Havana, so to speak, Karzai. But he did speak to him by phone. Now, the question is, why would he go to Afghanistan to speak to the head of Afghanistan by phone? Couldn't he have spoken to him by phone from the White House? Wouldn't that have been more green? Now, this can't be related to the WikiLeaks scandal, can it, and the missing money, can it? Or is this an attempt to boost troop morale over the latest Don't Ask, Don't Tell controversy? Or is he running away from the new unemployment numbers where unemployment rose to 9.8%? Well, it's really higher than that. Do you need any further proof that Obama's economic policies are about equal to that of a young Joseph Stalin and they're not working? How have you been affected by this downturn in the economy? Well, those are some of the questions, the pardon list. Obama goes to Afghanistan to thank the troops. More men have died in Afghanistan in the last few months than have died in the 2010 death toll of U.S. troops in the years that of 2001 to 2008 combined. It's awful. Just awful. Just horrible. Only 39,000 jobs in November. Boehner says Dem leaders should stop wasting time on tax hike votes. Somebody from Time says the Democrats are in the midst of a nervous breakdown. Whatever that means, midst of a nervous breakdown. They've always been in the midst of a nervous breakdown, haven't they? I think they've always been in the midst of a nervous breakdown. And here, this is something about the WikiLeaks scandal, so to speak. Wesley Pruden, who's one of the most brilliant analysts in America today, he's the editor emeritus of the Washington Times. Here's what he said about WikiLeaks. So far, we've seen and heard nothing explode except for a few soggy firecrackers, like rude noises in a church pew. A few editors, notably at the New York Times, are posing as heroes of the free world, but it's only a pose. The leaker, Julian Assange, an Australian, is painted as James Bond, but he's more like, in the apt description of one anonymous internet blogger, quote, a little boy playing at being a mystery hero, and like so many of the childish left, he is utterly bewitched by his own, by his sense of self-importance. I think that says it all, Doug. So that's important to know, that there are others who see this for what it isn't, which is that it's a much ado about nothing. Sort of like a bacteria that thrives on arsenic. That's what Julian Assange is. He's sort of like a bacteria that thrives on non-scandals, you know. That's more or less what it comes down to. You know, today Obama pardoned, nine people. We have the names. Are you ready for them? Are you ready for them? Are you ready for them? Here's the people that Obama pardoned. James Bernard Banks, Liberty, Utah. Offense, illegal possession of government property. Sentence October 31st, 1972, 2 years of probation. Oh, well. Number two, Russell James Dixon, felony liquor law violation, 1960, Northern District of Georgia, 2 years of probation. I guess they wanted it off their records. Sounds like minor stuff to me. Lawrence Dorsey, offense, conspiracy to defraud the United States by making false statements to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, 5 years probation in 1998. So far, not a big deal. Number four, a pardon by Obama, Ronald Lee Foster, Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. Offense, mutilation of coins, 1963. What the heck is that, Doug? East, 1 year of pro. So he just wanted that wiped off his record. 1963, mutilation of coins. What, he put one on a railroad track? Here's number five. Timothy James Gallagher, Navasota, Texas. Offense. Conspiracy to distribute and possess with intent to distribute cocaine. October 1982. 3 years probation. Number six, Roxanne K. Hettinger, Powder Springs, Georgia. What a perfect place that is for someone whose offense was conspiracy to distribute cocaine. Going back to 1986. Number seven, Edgar Leopold Kranz Jr., Minot, North Dakota. Offense, wrongful use of cocaine. That's interesting. Wrongful, you mean there's a rightful use of cocaine, I guess, in Utah. North Dakota, there's rightful. Adultery and writing three insufficient fund checks, 1994. General court martial convened at Hickam Air Force Base, Hawaii. Bad conduct, discharge suspended. Okay. Number eight, pardoned by Obama, Floretta Levy, Rockford Ill. Offense, distribution of cocaine. Dating back to, I don't know when. I don't know what this, how does this work? How do you get pardoned? 1984. Finally, Scooey Lathaniel Morris, Crosby, Texas. Offense, passing counterfeit obligations or securities. Okay, well, all right. Doesn't seem like pardoned anyone really big here. So let's have some rock and roll while we're playing. So let's have some more rock and roll.
Love it, darling. Come and go with me. Come with me. Way beyond the sea. I need you, darling. So come go with me.
All right. I'll be right back.
Come into my heart. Me, darling. We will never part. I need you, darling.
My book, the bestseller, Trickle Up Poverty, exposes what Obama is doing and how he's doing it. We're starting to see others picking up on what's really going on. You see, in a recent article entitled The Class Warfare President, Grace Vuto talks about how Obama is becoming the Great Divider, which I've talked about for months now.
Thanks, Michael, for having me on. You know, Michael, President Barack Obama, in his current discussion on our tax policy, really seems to misunderstand the very nature of America. The Democrats are insisting that we have to extend the Bush tax cuts according to different classes. So he wants to extend it to the middle class, but not to those making above $250,000. Really, what he is saying is that he is the arbiter in our society among the rich and the poor. What he doesn't understand is that in America, we don't envy the wealthy. We don't want to tear down the wealthy. Americans, essentially, the average American, wants to join the wealthy class. And that is what distinguishes us, in many ways, from nations like France and Cuba and Kenya, where there is envy among the classes. In America, the American dream is precisely the idea that anybody from any class can rise to join the wealthy elite. And we celebrate that. That's the American way. That's the American dream. Instead, the president and the Democrats, when they talk about tax policy now, they're trying to pit the middle class against the wealthy elite. And this rhetoric has to be condemned.
You think this is a responsible president to turn one class against another?
I think this is the height of being massive debt to this massive spending binge. And now he wants to confiscate the wealth of the rich in order to pay for the programs that he is using to benefit the lower classes. This is socialism. There's no other word for it. So he's not being responsible. He's being extremely irresponsible. And in fact, I want to point out that the founding fathers were railing against this very situation. Remember that the British imperial government had accumulated massive war debts. And in order to pay for those war debts, they told the American colonists, we've got to tax you. And they told the columnists, you know, these debts that we've incurred them for you, on your behalf, and therefore we're entitled to tax you.
Mm-hmm.
And in America, the columnists said, no. And that's how they forged their American national identities. You know, immediately they looked around and they said, we've got a common goal, we've got a common enemy. We're not going to be taxed by this body, even if that body is telling us that they're doing it for our own good.
Well, regarding taxes, you say the Founding Fathers feared the masses almost as much as British rule. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean, Michael, is that essentially, when the Founding Fathers created the New Republic, there were two things that they were trying to guard against. One was arbitrary one-man rule, which is, say, the power of a monarch, the power of a very formidable central government. The other thing that they feared was they feared the masses. And at the time, there was great discussion about the possible tyranny of the masses. There was great fear that the masses, for example, could vote for somebody, could appoint somebody to use the power of the state to confiscate the wealth and property of the rich for themselves. And so one of the things that the Founding Fathers warned against was you don't give the central government too much power, precisely because the impoverished masses or the lower classes might want to use that power to take away the property and wealth from the rich. And so the Founding Fathers were very careful to try to ensure that the state that they created would have barriers against both arbitrary rule and against the possibility of the masses making one class subservient to another. And that's what I see in this rhetoric on taxes. It's as though we're saying that one class has to be given certain rights and privileges that another class should not be given. This is fundamentally unfair, and it's fundamentally un-American.
Haven't the Americans always bared the brunt of heavy taxes?
No, and that is a huge misconception. For the first 80 or so years of the American Republic, the central government had very few taxes. This only began to accelerate during the Civil War, but really the main culprit was 1913, when the central government instituted the income tax, especially the graduated income tax. Progressives argue that, you know, this is a way of being fair, but in reality, what the progressive income tax does is it's just a means for the central government to take from the wealthy to give to the poor. It's a means of confiscation. And what we're seeing today is the same kind of rhetoric. So I want Americans out there to understand that this wasn't always the case. The central government should be very restrained in its exercise on taxes. It was for the first almost 100 years of our history. And that we accept otherwise just shows how ignorant we are of where we come from. The central government should be restrained in its taxation when it comes to both the poor, the middle class, and the rich.
Well, you're repeating what I say, that Obama doesn't understand most of America.
You know, what? One thing I recommend is that he goes back and rereads some of his campaign speeches, especially those in 2008, when he kept saying that we're not red states or blue states. We are the United States of America. He would be well to remember that what united us in the very beginning was exactly this opposition to the government acting so arbitrarily on taxes. And one of the things I hope that your listeners really take away from this interview, Michael, is that I am saying we should have a class-blind tax policy. When the government institutes some kind of policy on taxes, it should not discriminate amongst the classes. So I hope that we can use that phrase, a phrase that I've coined, a class-blind tax policy. Taxes should be leveled equally amongst all the classes, and any other alternative is fundamentally unfair and un-American.
What's your plan for keeping big government out of our pockets?
Well, we have to ensure that when we argue against the left, we're not just making a dollars and cents argument. I think the Republicans are doing a very good job of saying, listen, if you tax those who make more than $250,000 or more than $1 million, you're essentially going to nip in the bud the engine of job creation, because small businesses create jobs. So I think that's a very good dollars and cents argument. But we should have a better argument, too, one based on principle. And I think the more we advocate for this principle, the more we will at least be able to mitigate the government's confiscatory tax policies. So we have to take a stand on the principle that, look, if you have a tax policy, it should be fair for all the classes, and that you shouldn't arbitrarily be saying which class, you know, gets a tax break and which class does not.
Are there any signs that things are going to get better?
Well, I think that the Tea Party protests really do resemble some of the animus that was building before the revolution in 1776. There's a great sense amongst the American public that the government is being far too invasive in every sphere of our lives. And what we're seeing in this current tax debate is that President Obama doesn't understand what makes America really distinct and unique, is that we don't want to have tax policies which pit the classes amongst each other, because ultimately we all aspire to join the wealthy, and that's what makes America the beacon of light that it is all around the world. Here in America, it is possible. There's so much social mobility. So we don't want to have a tax structure where the pursuit of wealth is punished in any way, shape, or form.
Where can we read more?
They can read it at edmundburkeinstitute.org. Click on the link on the homepage which says, "And the Founding Fathers Said," and the article itself is called "The Class Warfare President."
Dr. Grace, thanks again for being on the Savage Nation.
Thank you so much, Michael, for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Look, I've laid out much of this in Trickle Up Poverty, step by step what is going on and how to stop it. Get the book for Christmas. Get informed.
Savage.
Where are you, little star?
Where are you?
Oh, 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 ra-da-da-da-da-da. Oh, 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 ra-da-da-da-da-da.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder where you are.
1-800-449-8255, other stories out there. Hillary Clinton says, Secretary of State will be my last public position. Do you believe her? Do you believe that it'll be her last public position? I don't believe it. Secretary of State is my last public position. I don't know what that means. I hope it's true, frankly. I mean, she can give so much more to the world in the private sector. Here's what's on michaelsavage.com, really. You have to look at these stories. Some of them are shocking, and I haven't seen them posted anywhere else except the original sources. The Lockerbie bomber's family is going to sue for false imprisonment and neglect. They said that the Lockerbie bomber didn't really do it. And Helen Thomas, you remember the lunatic, the charming Helen Thomas, who everyone would titter over every time she said something anti-American or anti-Jewish? And they put up with it because they're all anti-American and anti-Jewish. Helen Thomas lavishes hate against Jews, came out today. Old Helen Thomas said, we are owned by propagandists against the Arabs. There's no question about that, she said. Congress, the White House, the Hollywood, Wall Street are all owned by the Zionists, said old Helen Thomas, the woman they couldn't get, well, enough of. You know, they couldn't get enough of her. She's 90 years old. But she stands by her controversial comments, where she said that the Zionists control everything. Thomas, who grew up in Detroit, the daughter of Lebanese immigrants, was in Dearborn today for an Arab Detroit workshop on anti-Arab bias. Oh. And so she felt free to sling mud and hated the Jews. She said, I paid the price for my comments, but it was worth it to speak the truth. The Zionists have to understand that's their country, too. Palestinians were there long before any European Zionists. Well, she says, we are owned by propagandists. There's no question about that, she said. Congress, the White House, and Hollywood, Wall Street are owned by the Zionists. No question, in my opinion, said the 90-year-old hag. They put their money where their mouth is. We're being pushed into a wrong direction in every way. Wow, so it's everything now. Anti-Semitic stereotypes used by Hitler, to be used for more than a century to incite hatred against Jews. Ooh, her comments should be condemned by all people who oppose bigotry, I would think. But I don't see any such condemnation coming out of the outhouse. Do you?
No, it's just...
In her speech to about 300 inside a center in Dearborn, she asked how she would respond to those who say she's anti-Semitic. She said, I'm a Semite. What are you talking about? Who are you? She says, we all know the Arabs are much maligned. They're automatically terrorists. I was called the Hezbollah. Well, you get the picture. 90 years old. There it is. Apologist for the terrorists. Sympathy for the devil. Stories on MichaelSavage.com. Didn't make it to your local paper. Stop Obama from destroying our national security. For God's sakes, read Trickle Up Poverty while you still can, before it's banned by the Obama administration. There are many, many other stories. I'm not going to... There's one interesting one on my website. It's an offer you can't refuse. The family is selling the Godfather Mansion from the movie from 1972. Take a guess where the house is located. That's right. It's not on Long Island. Remember that house with the gates? 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Look, I know you worry about what's going on in Afghanistan from what's going on in the White House. But with all of that, you shouldn't have to worry about your computer on top of everything else. So go visit my advertisers at carbonite.com. They'll back up all your important files so they're safe no matter what happens. Use my offer code SAVAGE, and you're going to get 2 months free with your subscription. That's carbonite.com, offer code SAVAGE. Well, I'm glad that I could be with you on the Savage Nation. This is AM radio. Never forget it. This is the big league. This is Yankee Stadium. This is the Yankee Stadium of the media. You know, make no mistake about it. This is the big, big arena. I had a dream about this last night. I'm deeply in touch with my subconscious, or shall I say my subconscious is deeply in touch with me, which is interesting unto itself. And in the dream, I remember thinking, God, that's good, but it's not AM radio. God, that's good, but he's not in AM radio. Because I realize this is the cauldron here. This is it. This is it. This is the big league. Every breath, every word, every inflection, every insight, every mistake is heard around the world. It's a business like no other. I was in the dental chair. I went for minor dental work. And the dentist said to me, how are you doing? And I told her. She said, are you still enjoying it? I said, yes. I said, but it's very difficult. She said, why? As the drill, you know, as she scraped away at Mount Rushmore of my teeth. I said, because it's a business like no other. I said, one wrong word and you lose everything. I said, one wrong word in this business and you lose everything. I don't think there's another business like it other than politics, where one wrong word could destroy you. Do you know that? Which is why it's very sad our political class has become leaderless. It's not that they're stupid. It's not that they're incapable of leading us, some of them. It's that the times that we live in make it almost impossible to say what you really mean unless you really are so confident in what you mean is going to, you know, be supported. You don't say anything. You talk and double talk. The politicians speak in rhymes. They say nothing, so we've lost interest in them. So who do we turn to? We turn to talk radio. That's absolutely true. We absolutely turn to talk radio for any conversation today. Doesn't mean there isn't any other conversation out there. I was on a friend's yacht the other night, Labor Day, and I met some young people, younger than me by a couple of decades. They happened to be from a South American nation. Lovely couple. Young children weren't there, and we talked. They didn't even know me. I didn't know them. I was introduced by... We just had I had a beer, they had drank, blah, blah, blah. He cooked some meat, and we talked. So there are very intelligent people out there who talk with each other, obviously. But I'm talking about in the media. There's no other dialogue. Certainly it's not on ABC, CBS, or NBC. It's a format that doesn't lend itself to conversation. Television, they've tried the talk format in television. It doesn't work for whatever reason. I've seen it tried. Yes, Joan, you're on from Columbus, Ohio. What do you say, Joan? Blah, blah, blah. Somehow it doesn't grip me. Why does talk radio grip you? Why do millions of people rely upon talk radio for their link to reality? I ask myself, but I know the answer. I, Merlin the Magician of Talk Radio, know the answer. Why? Because there's no props. There's no props. There's no makeup. There's no lights. There's no distractions. There's no flashes. Every minute a flash with the news on television. You can get Petite Mal watching the news. And the crossing in the legs and the lipstick in the hair. The poor girls, what they have to do to attract your attention. I don't have any of that. And even if I could, I wouldn't cross my legs and put on lipstick for your attention. I don't have to do that. So what do I have? Nothing but my brains, my heart, my knowledge, and my voice. That's all. And if you're lucky enough to be able to combine all of that and project it out into the media, through the media to the world, you're a very lucky man. But it's all a miracle. At the end of the day, it's all a miracle. I guess I believe in miracles in that regard. Mr. Pragmatist here, Michael Savage, hard-nosed savage, believes in miracles. It's all a miracle. You want to hear something amazing? If you open up the Bible, the Jewish prayer book, rather, I want to read one paragraph. Please indulge me. You want to hear something? Here is the morning prayer that a religious man is supposed to read every morning. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has formed man in his wisdom and created within him numerous orifices and cavities. It is revealed and known before the throne of your glory that if one of them were to be blocked or one of them were to be opened, it would be impossible to exist even for a short while. Blessed are you, Lord, who heals all flesh and performs wonders. Now, think about that. When was that written? Before the age of anatomy? The ancient Jews knew about arteries and veins, that if one of them were to be blocked or one of them were to be opened, it would be impossible to exist even for a short while. So let's say you're a warrior. Let's say all day long you worry about a heart attack. Oh, God, every cringe in a car. You're 32 years old, you have two children or whatever, and every second you feel indigestion, you think you're dying. Oh, my God, what's that? Cardioneurosis, every second. What you're really doing is praying, but you don't realize it. By fearing death, you're actually reaching out to God and saying, please don't kill me. I have two young children, or I'm alone. I don't want to die here in the car. I don't want to crash into a light pole. In essence, it's very funny when you think about it, but the fear of disease and fear of death, obsessional fear of death and disease, is actually a few steps removed from worship of God, the worship of God. I'm the only one who's ever seen this. It was revealed to me in a dream. God told me to tell you that today. So let's say you're not only a hypochondriac of a minor order, but a major hypochondriac. What you're really doing is sublimating your wish to pray to God to keep you alive another second. And so it would be simpler if actually you stopped being a hypochondriac and you actually prayed to God six times a day and said these prayers in whatever language or whatever means you meant to. You just say, God, you know, we have all these vessels and these this and these that. And you know what? I'm enjoying my life. I'm not a bad guy. Or say to yourself what I learned to say the other day. I saw it in a Chinese fortune cookie. Do you know that I learned from a Chinese fortune cookie if it's good? Do you know that I can learn from a Chinese fortune cookie? I must have read them for 30 years and thrown them out. They're silly. I saw one the other day that I swear to God saved me. You know what it said? It saved me temporarily. It said, your virtues outweigh, your virtues outweigh your faults. That's what it said. Your virtues outweigh your faults. You know when I get down on myself, I immediately go into that statement. When I say, oh, I did this, I did that, how come I didn't do this? Why didn't I do more push-ups? Why didn't I say nicer to this one? Why did I lose my temper? You know what that is. That's the road to perdition when you're starting with that one. Don't beat yourself up. Say your virtues outweigh your faults. We all have faults. But are your virtues more than your faults? Good. That's it. So a human being. So that's why I'm giving you this religious stuff today, because I want to. How do you feel about it, though? That's what I'm asking you. You like it or you don't like it? You want me to stop it never again? You want me to do it more? You want me to do it less? I mean, look, America has a hardcore religious base. You take a highway that runs from the east coast of Florida, and it goes all the way through the southern states. I have a friend in the media who says to me, why? He said, I listen to you on Highway 40. He said, I get you from one state to the next, all through the night, all through the day. He likes to drive in a car alone. He collects his thoughts or whatever. He said, you're on Highway 40. I pick you up Louisiana, then I get you in Texas. then I get you in the panhandle, and then I get you in New Mexico, then I get you in Arizona. He said, you got to stay on the air. He said, Michael, you're the voice of America. I'll be right back.
Savage.
You know, the economy has, I wouldn't say the economy has come off the rails, I say the train has come off the rails. Congress refuses to move on tax cuts. And what does Obama do? He flies to Afghanistan to talk to the troops.
It is great to be back. Let me first of all thank the 101st Airborne Division Band. Where's the band? Give them a big round of applause. Thank you. To Chief Thomas Hager and the commander and conductor. I gather we had a couple of other bands playing Manifest Destiny and Nuts. I don't know about, you know, I don't know how they sounded. What do you think? Were they pretty good? It is great to be back. And I apologize for keeping you guys up late.
Commander-in-Chief. It's more like the cheerleader-in-chief.
I want to thank General Petraeus, not only for the introduction and the T-shirts.
T-shirts?
But for General Petraeus' lifetime of service. This is somebody who has helped change the way we fight wars and win wars in the 21st century. And I am very grateful that he agreed to take command of our efforts here in Afghanistan. He has been an extraordinary warrior on behalf of the American people. Thank you, David Petraeus.
Oh, boy, he really thinks he's winning?
As President of the United States, I have no greater responsibility than keeping the American people secure. I could not meet that responsibility. We could not protect the American people. We could not enjoy the blessings of our liberty without the extraordinary service that each and every one of you perform, each and every day. So on behalf of me, on behalf of Michelle, on behalf of Malia and Sasha, on behalf of more than 300 million Americans, we are here to say thank you. We are here to say thank you for everything that you do.
So he travels 10,000 miles to talk to the troops about his own family? I believe they could use more than empty words, Mr. President. Meanwhile, what's going on back home? Nancy Pelosi wants to drain the Treasury even more than has already been drained.
Unemployment insurance, the economists tell us, return $2 for every dollar that is put out there for unemployment insurance. People need the money. They spend it immediately for necessities. It injects demand into the economy. It creates jobs to help reduce the deficit.
And Bonnie Frank is busy using his silver tongue to attack the Republicans.
We need to be clear about what the right wing is saying. We care so much about the deficit that we can't extend unemployment for people who are out of work, although some of them have this ideological view that it's just lazy people, and if you make their children suffer enough, they'll stop hanging out at the beer parlor and go get a job, apparently.
Maybe they were talking about him.
By taking money away from funds that now go for other important purposes, like keeping police and firefighters on the street. What they're saying is they can't do unemployment without paying for it, but far more than the cost of unemployment will be added to the deficit if you give people making hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars a year a tax cut. So what I'm saying is that this concern for the deficit is a sham.
Barney, your entire Democrat Party is a sham. Hello, Mr. and Mrs. North and South America and all the ships at sea. Let's go to press. I don't care if you're in a cloud form that's Sirius, or Cirrocumulus, or Cirrostratus, Altostratus, Altocumulus, Stratocumulus, Stratus, Nimbostratus, Cumulus, or Cumulonimbus. You're all welcome to listen to the Savage Nation, no matter what the barometric pressure or wind direction may be. All right, turn it off. I wanted to have some fun. I wanted to show you my range. You know, sometimes I get... I get bored and I come up with something in the middle of nothing. I use the old windshield thing and I did this. Because the weather is a very important phenomenon. You didn't know I knew all of the cloud formations. I'm a boater. I know all this stuff. And I took the boat up the coast. About an hour up the coast, you know something. There's something to be said for being at sea. Not another boat in sight. What a pleasure. What a pleasure not to be, you know, cut off by a yahoo and this and that. And the dog lifts up his head and he breathes in the air. You know, it was beautiful. There was one negative, as everything, because there's absolutely no perfection on the planet. There's no such thing as goodwill towards man. Or like one day, give me one day where everything goes right. Even the boat ride, you're not going to believe this. I'm 2 miles off, a mile or two offshore. You know, the landform is on the right. I'm passing a certain area. All of a sudden, a bunch of flies fly onto the boat. Like a little tribe of flies fly on the boat, and they start bothering me. And they're not normal flies. There's some kind of weird, like, sea fly. I don't know what they're called. They have, like, little crawly things. Like, they crawl like cockroaches. And no matter what you do, I use the old European underwear, undershirt swing. You can't kill them. I didn't know what to do. So the next day, I prepared. We went and got... You're not going to believe it. It's disgusting. I got fly paper. They still sell fly paper. God bless the guy who still makes fly paper. I had to go back the next day onto the boat and hang fly paper from the inside of the boat because I was afraid that they, like, breed in 2 days. They would lay eggs somewhere, and I'd wake up, there'd be 10 million flies on the boat. Oh, God.
Savage.